following is for your ears only. I'm David Alpern, continuing the final farewell month of this program with newsmakers, experts, and top reporters from some memorable segments of the last 23 and a half years. First, High Emotion, Higher Hopes, Pulitzer-winning LBJ biographer Robert Caro on a key piece of the path to Obama's first nomination. Then OBL, Obliteration, how the secret mission to kill Osama bin Laden would and would not change the shape of terrorism facing America and the world as we now see. Next, what Trayvon taught, how a white Neighborhood Watch volunteer killing an unarmed black youth first revealed realities of race, guns, and justice in the age of Obama. Going back further, autism, Rain Man, and reality. Actor Dustin Hoffman talks about the film that helped broaden the nation's understanding and empathy. Finally, Nora's Neck, Efron that is, the late great journalist, essayist, author, and film director on facing age and its discontents. For your ears only, for the week of September 14th, 2014, I'm David Alpern with a quote from last week's news. A troubling divergence. That was high-profile Harvard professor Michael Porter in a new survey of business leaders that found little chance an improving corporate economy would lead to better pay or conditions for American workers. Now, this view of high hopes and historic politics from our August 31st, 2008 show.
I realize that I'm not the likeliest candidate for this office. I don't fit the typical pedigree, and I haven't spent my career in the halls of Washington. But I stand before you tonight because all across America, something is stirring. If John McCain wants to have a debate about who has the temperament and judgment to serve as the next commander-in-chief, that's a debate I'm ready to have.
I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal.
There were dreams embodied and dreams denied in Denver last week. First, Hillary and Bill Clinton used their convention moments to boost Barack Obama, whatever their earlier doubts. Then the first ever major party African-American presidential nominee launched his campaign for change with clear challenges to his GOP opponent, not only on policy and experience, but on temperament, a sometimes explosive issue for John McCain. And the moment was doubly historic, coming on the 45th anniversary of Martin Luther King's unforgettable I Have a Dream speech, which we bring to you courtesy of the King Estate. For more on the messages from Denver, the backstage politics, and the impact on undecided voters, especially women, now that McCain has chosen Alaska Governor Sarah Palin as his running mate, we have Newsweek contributing editor and TV commentator Eleanor Clift. And with some thoughts about another historic speech that figures in Obama's nomination, we have Robert Caro, Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer of President Lyndon Johnson. First, Eleanor, do the endorsements of Bill and Hillary Clinton reflect real healing of the rift with Obama?
I think the Clintons did everything they could to say that this election is not about Hillary, that it's about the issues that she represented, and that Barack Obama is closer to her on those issues than John McCain. It seems to me there will be probably some diehards left, but that the kind of voter who was drawn to Hillary Clinton, I think, is probably going to make the transition to Barack Obama. But John McCain, with his choice of the Alaska governor, seems to think that there is still rich territory out there to get these voters, because I think his choice reflects the decision on the part of his campaign that he needs to win over some of the women, who mostly women, who supported Hillary Clinton, and that they might be drawn to his ticket if they see a woman placed on the ticket, and that she might somehow assuage their disappointment.
What have you learned about the state of communication and coordination between the Clinton and Obama camps?
Well, the Obama camp let the Clintons handle the convention speeches on their own, and they exercised quite strict control about over everybody else. And so I think that indicated a level of trust, although there was certainly nervousness about it. But the Clintons delivered for them. So I think that probably gives them a foundation of trust from which to go forward in this campaign.
Do you see the Democrats going further to exploit McCain's legendary short temper, and how?
Well, I was a little surprised that Barack Obama went at that in his convention speech. He's been under some pressure to show toughness in taking his case to John McCain, and the fact that he said that he looked forward to a debate on readiness to be president, a debate that centered on temperament and judgment. And I think that's the first time that temperament has been put out there so obviously, and I think they've kind of shied away from that. But after a month of taking character attacks from McCain campaign and their allies, I think that the Obama campaign decided it was time for them to return the fire, and I think clearly that opens the door to a the use of McCain's explosive temper on occasion as a campaign issue.
Newsweek's Eleanor Cliff. Next to Lyndon Johnson biographer Robert Caro, while coverage of Obama's speech had to include replays of Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech, you also were remembering another speech by LBJ that played a key role in the Obama story. When and what was it?
Well, it was Lyndon Johnson's 1965 speech when he announced to a joint session of Congress that he was going to introduce and push for a Voting Rights Act which would allow Negroes in the South to vote. As he said, at that time, blacks, of course everyone referred to them as Negroes then, only about one out of 11 black voters in the South got to vote, so they were not a political force.
And he picked up a refrain of the civil rights movement for his for that 1965 speech.
Yes, it was quite one of the most dramatic moments in 20th century political history. They were marching down in Selma, men and women and children being beaten by the police, getting up and marching again and singing the great civil rights hymn, "We Shall Overcome." Everyone said that Lyndon Johnson could never get a Voting Rights Act through Congress because of the Southern strength. He stood up before Congress and he said, "It's not just Negroes." These are his words. "It's not just Negroes, but really it is all of us who must overcome the crippling legacy of bigotry and injustice." Then he paused and he said, "And we shall overcome." At that moment, it was the President of the United States had, in effect, joined the voices of all those who were singing that hymn down in Selma and across the South and saying he, as president, would fight for them.
Hillary Clinton drew considerable criticism, especially from African Americans, by arguing that it took a president like Johnson, as well as Dr. King, to realize the civil rights revolution. But you learned that Dr. King himself was quite overwhelmed by Johnson adopting the "We Shall Overcome" refrain. Talk about that.
David, you know, when Martin Luther King was listening to the speech, he was in the living room of a local family in Selma. And when Lyndon Johnson said, "We shall overcome," Martin Luther King started to cry. His aides had never seen Dr. King cry before during all the years of struggle. It was as if he realized that now he had a president of the United States on his side. You know, you needed both of them. You needed the heroism and struggle of the black men and women across the South and across America for civil rights to create this rising tide of national feeling. But you also needed someone with the legislative genius and really the savage will to get things done of a Lyndon Johnson to push that act through against the Southern power in Congress. And that's what we finally had, this partnership.
Robert Caro has won Pulitzer Prizes for his biographies of Lyndon Johnson and New York master builder Robert Moses. We also spoke with Newsweek's Eleanor Clift.
From our August 31st, 2008 broadcast, now this quote from last week's news. "When the going gets tough, they abandon Latinos and their issues as fast as you can say piñata." That was America's Voice Executive Director Frank Sherry on congressional Democrats and President Obama for delaying executive action on immigration reform until after the November midterm elections to avoid undermining the party's chances. A new NBC Wall Street Journal poll showed more Americans favoring Republicans over Democrats on the issue, 35% to 27%. The poll also showed 48% opposition to Obamacare versus 34% support. Next, OBL obliteration, the changing face of terrorism, for your ears only. We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern with the best segment from our May 8th, 2011 show and co-host Melissa Exelberth.
I can report to the American people and to the world that the United States has conducted an operation that killed Osama bin Laden, the leader of al-Qaeda. There's no doubt that al-Qaeda will continue to pursue attacks against us. We must and we will remain vigilant at home and abroad.
It's very hard to believe that some elements of the Pakistani government, whether it's the military or intelligence, were not aware of this.
The end of Osama bin Laden, as announced so dramatically by President Obama last week, began a new phase in the worldwide terror war, in America's Afghan operations, and in relations with the Muslim world, particularly nuclear-armed Pakistan, where the head of al-Qaeda was living in a well-to-do, heavily military suburb of Islamabad. Indeed, New York's Republican Congressman Peter King was hardly alone in questioning the competence or complicity of at least some elements of Pakistan's army and intelligence services, despite millions of dollars in U.S. support.
Pakistan also was embarrassed not to have detected the helicopters carrying Navy SEALs to the compound or a nearby U.S. intelligence outpost that had been keeping an eye on it for some time after years of interrogation and analysis identified a bin Laden courier and tracked him there. To consider these and other issues raised by the mission, for Your Ears Only, we're joined again by Bruce Hoffman, director of the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University's School of Foreign Service. Welcome back to our program.
Thank you very much for having me.
Were you surprised that bin Laden was not hiding in a border cave and, according to evidence seized at his compound, that he had continuing contact with his al-Qaeda minions?
No, I have to say I wasn't on either count. For at least the past 5 years, I've been writing and arguing that there was a more defined command and control structure to al-Qaeda than many people had assumed, and that the old senior leadership was playing an extremely active role. With respect to bin Laden himself, it didn't surprise me because almost all the arrests of high-value al-Qaeda operatives made in Pakistan occurred in cities. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, for example, Ramzi bin al-Shaib, Abu Faraj al-Libi were all seized in major cities. And in essence, it makes more sense today than even in past years when they were apprehended why bin Laden would hide in a city, because there's not the same danger, at least he calculated, of, for instance, being spotted and then becoming the target, for instance, of a Predator, Hellfire missile strike.
Given all the offshoots of al-Qaeda around the world and the self-recruiting of would-be terrorists, even within the United States, what actual impact do you see from killing bin Laden as a leader and as a symbol?
Well, as a leader and a symbol, it certainly throws the movement off balance, not least because of this treasure trove of intelligence information and data that we've been able to seize. At the very minimum, all of his operatives and all of his confederates are going to be looking over their shoulders far more than they might have been doing in recent years, wondering if we're not on their trail because of that information. So I think its disruptive potential really is enormous.
Who's the next most important U.S. target, al-Qaeda co-founder Ayman al-Zawahiri or American-born firebrand Anwar al-Awlaki, the internet inspiration of various recent terror attacks?
This is the problem with how terrorism has developed over the past decade. Years ago, it just would have been bin Laden or his deputy, and I believe his heir apparent, Ayman al-Zawahiri. But as al-Qaeda, unfortunately, has expanded, it's no longer one enemy in one place at one time, but rather we see many al-Qaedas in different places with different capabilities. And just as your question suggests, we now have to contend with an al-Qaeda offshoot that in recent months, the director of the CIA, the director of National Intelligence, and the director of the National Counterterrorism Center have all said that al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula and Anwar al-Awlaki are as dangerous and threatening to American interests as even the parent al-Qaeda group. So one has to say both.
On the other hand, how do you see al-Qaeda and its offshoots contending with the pro-democracy protests that are now rocking the Muslim world? Are they really competing for, you know, the future leadership, the direction of discontent?
That's an interesting question. I think not so much competing with them directly, because I don't think that al-Qaeda really ever had much of a profound following amongst many Muslims across North Africa and the Middle East. Al-Qaeda's core constituency is and always has been the young hotheads. And they're still out there, after all. I mean, there may be more of them as there are disillusioned people from the Arab Spring. But where I think the Arab Spring does have an absolutely pivotal impact on al-Qaeda is stealing the headlines, stealing the media space, and stealing the bandwidth. Only a few months ago, anything that al-Qaeda did would be front-page news. because of very dramatic, very significant events across that entire region, Al-Qaeda now has to compete for an audience share that it's no longer assured of.
It seems Al-Qaeda's acknowledgement of bin Laden's death supports President Obama's decision not to release potentially inflammatory pictures of the body as proof. But one debate that continues is how important so-called enhanced interrogation or torture was to getting the tiny details that led to Osama's courier to the compound and to Osama himself. What's your best understanding of its role before being banned, at least officially?
Well, first and foremost, I think we just don't know, despite a lot of political claims for points to the contrary. It's very unclear what role it may have played. I mean, certainly at the time of the enhanced interrogations in Guantanamo, if you recall, the FBI and FBI agents there became appalled by these processes and said, we can get the same information without resorting to these means. And in fact, they left Guantanamo.
What's your view on the competence or complicity of Pakistan's army and intelligence services, who have been long suspected of supporting Al-Qaeda?
Well, whether it was active or passive, certainly bin Laden had to have received help and had to have people turning a blind eye for him to have lived for the past 5 years in an area that's very close to the Pakistani National Military Academy, that has many military and intelligence officers living there. So apart from the help that he would have had to have received, there's plenty of people that I think doubtlessly knew about it but didn't ask about it and didn't probe any deeply, and because of their silence or indifference, basically allowed him to survive as long as he did.
There are predictable calls in Congress to reconsider U.S. relations with Pakistan and continuing financial support, while others say the country is simply too critical to U.S. plans for Afghanistan, despite any duplicity. How do you think we should play it?
Well, the truth is they are critical in a number of different realms, not just to the ongoing U.S. campaign in Afghanistan, but also for regional peace and stability with respect to India. One has to bear in mind that Pakistan is a major nuclear power. We've never had any access to inspect or to survey their facilities and how well their weapons are protected, so we have to take it at their word that they're well protected. So unfortunately, I think this is a very delicate matter, but we still need Pakistan on our side. We still have to help Pakistan. And I think, after all, the biggest irritant in our relations with Pakistan was the question of where was Osama bin Laden? Was he hiding in Pakistan? Well, that's now being resolved. I think rather than recrimination, it's time to move ahead and hopefully forge a more effective relationship.
Bruce Hoffman is director of the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University's School of Foreign Service.
From our May 8, 2011 program, now a quote on the newest face of terrorism from last week's news. It's hard to imagine a better indication of the ability of elected officials and TV talking heads to spin the public into a panic. That was Daniel Benjamin, former top terrorism advisor at the State Department, one of many experts dubious about the threat ISIS currently poses to the U.S. despite growing numbers, or the threat that Obama's degrade and destroy strategy of airstrikes, military supplies, and training with uncertain allies actually poses to ISIS. The new NBC Wall Street Journal poll shows a near majority, 47%, believing that the country is less safe today than before 9/11/2001. 40% favor preventive airstrikes against ISIS. Another 34% back using U.S. ground forces as well. Next, what Trayvon taught. Race, guns, and justice. For your ears only. We have more for your ears only. With Eddie Robinson, I'm David Alpern, and this quote from last week's news. Nobody knows what special status means. That was an anonymous advisor to Ukraine President Petro Poroshenko about rights granted areas controlled by pro-Russian separatists under terms of a ceasefire negotiated with Moscow. But it seemed to be holding as 70% of Russian forces withdrew and promised U.S. military aid was reportedly stalled while new Western sanctions were authorized. Now, this segment from our July 21st, 2013 broadcast.
I think George Zimmerman is a man whose heart was in the right place, but just got displaced by the vandalism in the neighborhoods and wanting to catch these people so badly that he went above and beyond what he really should have done. George had a right to protect himself at that point.
No justice.
Trayvon Martin could have been me 35 years ago.
George Zimmerman may not have seemed totally innocent to Sanford, Florida juror B-37, but under the law of self-defense, she joined the unanimous verdict of not guilty on charges of second-degree murder or manslaughter in the fatal shooting of unarmed black teen Trayvon Martin. That produced a week of demonstrations around the country, calls for a Justice Department civil rights suit, repeal of state stand-by-your-ground laws, and an unusually personal comment by President Barack Obama. He urged greater understanding of the black perspective after generations of racial prejudice that he admitted was still a fact of life, though steadily fading.
To put the verdict and reaction in context, as he did originally when the case first drew national attention, for your ears only, we're joined again by Ellis Coase, author of The End of Anger, Colorblind, The Rage of a Privileged Class, and 8 more books on race and other social issues. What was your first reaction to the verdict?
Well, I guess I had 2. I mean, I was saddened, but I was not surprised. I never expected that Zimmerman would be convicted.
Some say the all-female, mostly white jury could not identify emotionally with Trayvon. Others say it was more that the law of self-defense just doesn't account for who begins a confrontation, only whether any party to it can prove fear for his life. What's your view?
Well, I think there were several gaps here. I mean, there's a gap between what most people, many people, consider wrong and what the state of Florida and other states would have these laws says is illegal. And I think it's absolutely right that under the law, it doesn't really matter what Zimmerman did, that he, in by many calculations, provoked this incident and then shot a guy who was only responding to him. What matters is that the law says that he was justified in doing what he did by any sort of logical reading. But I think at the same time, what the president spoke to, I guess, in his remarks, is that there is a huge gap between what many African Americans perceive and what many white Americans perceive. And this is not new. I mean, when Gallup did this poll last year, they found 51% of blacks saying that Zimmerman was definitely guilty and 11% of whites saying that he was definitely guilty. The vast majority, or the majority at least, of whites were saying that it was unclear who was wrong and who was right in this case. And at the end of the day, I'm not sure that even a jury that was half white and half black would have convicted him. I suspect they would not have, because they were instructed to follow the law, not to follow what they thought was right.
The original protests were to force a trial after cops just let Zimmerman go. Some say the extensive proceedings did honor Martin's death and that a civil suit plus endless fear of revenge may be punishment enough for Zimmerman. Others demand a Justice Department civil rights case, though it might be even harder to win. What do you think?
Well, I think several things. I mean, I think, one, there are lots of people who want justice in this case. And there's a distinction in what we perceive as justice and in what the law permits to happen in certain situations. And I don't think that the honoring of Trayvon Martin is going to happen through the justice system. I think it's going to be very, very difficult to bring a civil rights suit here. I mean, I'm not a lawyer, but I happen to have dinner with Ted Shaw, the former head of the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund, a couple of days after this verdict came out, and we were talking about it, and he said basically the same thing. It's going to be a very difficult civil rights suit if they do, in fact, decide to bring one. There can certainly be a civil suit, which has a lower bar, and they may meet that. But at least the legal system is not about honoring Trayvon Martin. That has to happen in the political system, in society, in the sort of social interactions of people.
Some thought Obama's comments were right on about race and prejudice, even against a black man on a path to the presidency. Others thought that they were too racially one-sided and provocative as the controversy continues. What was your reaction?
Well, it's an interesting commentary on America and our experiences. The fact of the matter is that our experience with race in America tends to be one-sided. Obama talked in quite personal terms about his experience being followed around in a store or a shop and other similar experiences like that. I've had that same experience when I was a kid, looking to buy my mom a birthday gift. I went into a store called Marshall Fields in Chicago, and I could not shake a store detective. This is not the kind of experience that most whites have. And so there's very little identification with that. And when someone like Obama or anyone else for that matter brings it up, there's a sense among many white Americans that he's playing some kind of race card, or that he's bringing, that he's injecting race into an area where it does not belong.
What's been your reaction to the talk about warnings that loving black parents have to give to their male teens even today?
It is a reality that I've talked with lots of black parents, and I wrote a book about young black men, so I'm certainly very aware of the situation with them. And there is a sense that in many situations that could be read ambiguously, young black men are going to be looked at with suspicion. I don't think that most are going to be, in effect, hunted down and shot. But there is this fear, and there is this concern of how you act in these circumstances where innocent acts can be perceived not so innocently. And there is, unfortunately, in this country, which has gone so far along the road of getting rid of racism, there are still some unfortunate racial stereotypes that slap black men in the face.
Ellis Coase is the author of The End of Anger, Colorblind, The Rage of a Privileged Class, and 8 more books on race and other social issues.
From our July 21st, 2013 broadcast, now this quote from last week's news. Civil disobedience does cause inconvenience, a small sacrifice. That was Eric Vickers, chief organizer of the highway blockade to protest a white policeman's fatal shooting of unarmed black teen Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. Also last week, a city council meeting there was disrupted by citizens hooting at several post-shooting law enforcement reforms as inadequate. 2 new white witnesses said they saw Brown shot with his hands up. Next, autism, Rain Man, and reality for your ears only. We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern with a quote from last week's news. Honda was aware of the problem. This should never have happened. That was Jennifer Griffin, whose exploding Civic airbag was among at least 140 made by the Takata company that have caused death or injury and led 11 car makers to recall more than 14 million vehicles, 5 times the number recalled this year by GM for potentially fatal ignition switches. Now, a January 1st, 1989 Newsweek On Air segment with co-host Warren Levinson of Associated Press.
Ray, do you know how much the square root of 2,130 is?
46.15192304. 2304.
Man, that is amazing. He should work for NASA. If you had a dollar and you spent 50 cents, how much money would you have left?
About 70.
70 cents.
A scene from the season's number one box office hit, Rain Man.
As autistic savant Raymond Babbitt, actor Dustin Hoffman provides an extraordinary depiction of amazing talents, severe limitations, and essential humanity.
The film also dramatizes the developing humanity of Raymond's brother Charlie, played by actor Tom Cruise, in what may be his best work to date.
Rain Man took 2 years, 4 directors, 6 writers, and at least 8 producers to get to your local theater, but its unpredictable success demonstrates how artistic commitment, largely Hoffman's, can triumph over all the hurdles Hollywood has to offer and produce a film that is medically accurate, emotionally irresistible, and commercially awesome, the Christmas film that just might save financially troubled MGM United Artists.
To discuss the making and the meaning of Rain Man, we're delighted to have Dustin Hoffman and Dr. Bernard Rimland of the Institute for Child Behavior Research in San Diego. Dr. Rimland is one of the nation's foremost authorities on autism and one of several medical consultants for the film. Dustin Hoffman, you first. You were first offered the role of Charlie, the normal brother, but you were drawn to the role of Raymond, the autistic savant. Why is that?
I think the reason is because by coincidence, by the way, hi, Bernie. By coincidence, when I got the script, I had seen a 60 Minutes about 3 or 4 weeks before on autistic savants, and it really moved me. In fact, I had asked to get a tape of it and had watched it again. And so when I read the script, it was suddenly, there was a savant on the page.
So this is total coincidence.
Yes. However, it was written as a retarded person and not as autistic. So I just started to become interested in autism at that point, and I knew nothing about it. And I realized that nothing had been seen about it. I don't think it had ever been put on the screen, although I was told there was someone I think, on a saint elsewhere.
You did a lot of reading and personal observation of people with mental disabilities, actually meeting a pair of brothers, one normal, one not. Tell us a little about them and what you drew from these experiences.
Well, I just talked to one of them yesterday. They become friends. One of the things I found was that, and also with Dr. Rimland's son as well, and a couple of others, Joe Sullivan and David Parsons, also Kim Peek, who the first writer originally based it on, with all of these people, there's a feeling that you get when you meet them and spend time with them, which is different from other mental disabilities, and that is that they appear quite normal, and if you just saw them on the street or sat in a restaurant or wherever, you wouldn't be able to see anything different. And then when they start talking and interacting with you, it's then that you begin to see the disability.
I gather you were able to shoot this movie in normal sequence, letting the characters and to some extent even the scenes change, develop naturally, even to the point of having several possible endings, happier endings with closer contact and communication between the brothers. Why did you avoid them in the end?
Well, that's the director. That's Barry Levinson, who I think did a wonderful job and was quite brave, who really deserves the credit for the way the film is mounted and also the essential message that it sends across, and that is that it's possible he was hoping that it would be possible to feel moved by this person and by these brothers without cheating. It was very important to Barry, as it was to me and Tom Cruise, because we had met with Dr. Rimland and a lot of other people, not to let them down, because you could see the skepticism in their eyes. They said, "Oh, Hollywood is going to do a film about this," and you know that they were going to go see another movie about mental illness, which was sentimentalized and somehow trivialized. And we felt if we could get past them, if we could make it work for the not only the medical profession, but the people that we had met, the autistic people and their families, that was really our first desire. And somehow there was no other ending, Barry felt. You couldn't, I mean, there just couldn't be any other ending.
There couldn't be a magical cure.
Well, that's funny you say that, because when you asked me, I think the first question you asked me, you said, is how did it feel to meet these people? The strongest feeling that we all had as you talk to these people, as you interact with people who are, and certainly these are high-functioning autistics, which are maybe 1% or whatever of the autistic population, this is as good as it gets, that you feel that if you say the right thing, if you kiss them, if you hold them, and you keep wanting to do these kind of affectionate things, that it will somehow be like a magic wand, and sometimes it will just go away. And I think that's the most difficult, painful thing for a parent or a loved one to live with these people, because I don't think that feeling ever goes away. And we felt, wouldn't it be wonderful if the audience felt that? And somehow, I guess that is the wish of the audience, is that somehow that magic wand will happen at the end, but it just isn't the truth. Maybe in the sequel. and in the sequel of research, really research being done with autism.
In the sequel on this segment, we'll turn from Dustin Hoffman to Dr. Bernard Rimland of the Institute for Child Behavior Research in San Diego.
Dustin Hoffman's office recently received a letter from an autistic 12-year-old. It said in part, "I love you. You played me on Rain Man. Rain Man is good. People say autism is okay. I'm free now. This is good Rain Man." Do you think many autistic persons would get that sense of support from this film?
Probably the most striking characteristic of autism is their failure to be able to empathize or put themselves in the place of other people. They cannot understand other people.
Well, the lesson may be lost on them, but I think the lesson of this movie is that it's not lost on the rest of us, and I think in the end that may do some good for all concerned. Thank you very much. We've been talking about autism and the box office hit About It, Rain Man. On the line, Dr. Bernard Rimland of the Institute for Child Behavior Research in San Diego and Rain Man star Dustin Hoffman.
From our January 1st, 1989 Newsweek on Air, Dr. Rimland died in 2006 after leading the switch away from earlier notions that autism was triggered by emotional trauma or mistreatment. Next, Nora's Neck, another Ephron analysis of aging for your ears only. Some final steps down memory lane for your ears only. I'm David Alpern, but first another quote from last week's news. The NFL has lost its way. That was Terry O'Neill, president of the National Organization for Women, as NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell indefinitely suspended Baltimore Ravens star Ray Rice after release of an elevator video that showed him punching his girlfriend, now wife, unconscious. Earlier video that showed Rice dragging her body from the elevator drew only a two-game suspension. After the AP reported the punch tape was sent to the NFL months ago, Goodell launched an independent review of NFL responses by former director Robert Mueller, though he works for a law firm with extensive NFL connections. Also last week, South Africa's double amputee track star Oscar Pistorius was found guilty of culpable homicide in the fatal shooting of his girlfriend, but not premeditated murder. Now from our July 23rd, 2006 Newsweek On Air broadcast with co-host Catherine Herzog.
When I get older, losing my hair many years from now, will you still be sending me a Valentine? Birthday greetings, bottle of wine.
Glad you are willing to, it's thrilling to the core. But make it fast before my facelift hits the floor. Don't ask a lady what the lady did before. Ask what the lady's doing before it all needs gluing.
Cabaret divas Andrea Markovici and Julie Wilson with two approaches to female aging, one faintly plaintive, the other distinctly defiant. Novelist, essayist, screenwriter, and director Nora Ephron has her own approach. The woman who gave us movies like When Harry Met Sally and Sleepless in Seattle, and books including Heartburn, Crazy Salad, and Wallflower at the Orgy, now confronts her 60s with characteristic mordant wit in a new collection of essays titled I Feel Bad About My Neck and Other Thoughts on Being a Woman, from Knopf next month.
While she may have come a long way in Hollywood, Ephron actually hasn't traveled all that far in terms of body parts she worries about. Her earliest notable essay was focused on small breasts, but she has proved prescient. We were both daily reporters in New York back in the mid-60s when I asked her about Newsweek, where I knew she had once been what they called a mail girl and where I had a job offer. Her answer has stayed with me, for better and worse, over my last 40 years here. Newsweek, she said, it's a hard place to leave. So now it gives me great pleasure to say, Nora Ephron, welcome to Newsweek On Air.
Thank you, David.
Do you laugh as much writing these essays as we do reading them, or were you close enough to tears to worry about shorting out your keyboard?
I don't think I was laughing or crying. I definitely felt when I got into my 60s that nothing I read about being in your 60s had the remotest connection to what I was feeling. I kept looking around at, you know, girlfriends. I was having lunch with girlfriends, right? We are not girls. But, you know, all of us wearing turtlenecks practically up to our noses or scarves so that we looked like sort of Katharine Hepburn in On Golden Pond, or Mandarin jackets so that we looked like a version of the Joy Luck Club. And I just thought, no one is writing about this. People write these books where they say, oh, it's so great to be older because you're so wise. And I just thought, what are they talking about?
Well, what is so bad about your neck? And isn't it something a little makeup or a plastic surgery could fix?
How old are you? Who are you? How old are you? The neck is the first thing to go. And you can kind of do all sorts of preemptive strikes against recognizing that fact, like failing to look in the mirror for several years. or when you do look in the mirror, you do that pathetic thing that many of us do, which is that you sort of gently pull the skin up, hoping that that's what you look like, or you kind of straighten your neck like some sort of fabulous swan. But at some point, you're going to catch a glimpse of it. Some really loving friend will send you a picture of yourself blowing out the candles on your 65th birthday cake, and you'll want to shoot yourself because there it is. I mean, I write in the book that you have to cut open a redwood tree to see how old it is, but you wouldn't have to if it had a neck. Necks are a dead giveaway.
You say in the book that there is the possibility of plastic surgery, but it requires a whole facelift, and you end up looking not like quite anybody you know, much less yourself.
Well, that's, of course, the danger of plastic surgery. I don't want to judge anybody who has it because anything that gets you through the night, that's how I look at it. But you have to be very careful of what you do and whom you go to, because you can end up looking in the mirror and actually seeing a total stranger, which is not a good thing, I think.
You also say you hate your purse, if only for what it says about you. What does it say?
Yes. I'm one of those women who hates her purse. Now, not all women do hate their purses. The world is full of women who have unnatural attachments to their purses and spend huge sums of money on them. But I look in my purse, and I'm sorry to say, I see myself. I see the complete and total disorganized mess I am. I see the boarding pass from the airplane trip 3 years ago and you know, little bits of tobacco, even though I haven't had a cigarette in about 35 years, and lipstick tops and loose Advils. And I just feel that purses are a nightmare. They're a nightmare. That just happens to be how I feel about them.
Nora Ephron's new book is I Feel Bad About My Neck from Knopf. We wish her well with an apt song her Sleepless in Seattle helped bring to a new generation.
You must remember this. A kiss is still a kiss. A sigh is just a sigh.
From our July 23, 2006 Newsweek On Air broadcast, Ephron died in June of 2012, but it's just been announced that a script she wrote about singer Peggy Lee soon will be filmed with Oscar winner Reese Witherspoon in the title role.
The fundamental things apply as time goes by.
And this has been For Your Ears Only. For this final month, For Your Ears Only On Air is also online at iTunes, YouTube, FeedBurner.com, and going back years now at archive.org/details/For Your Ears Only. This encore broadcast was engineered by Chad Dugatz at the Hangar Studio Play It Productions. I'm David Alpern. Our show is a nonprofit project of the New York Foundation for the Arts, supported by the GateWave.org radio reading service for those with disabilities, the Best Memorial Trust, and award-winning ACAM Associates. Exceptional management, impeccable reputation for New York co-ops, condos, and condops since 1983. Learn more at ACAM.com. Contact me at davidearsonly@gmail.com. Now we're back with another archive segment, normally a major story on our show a year ago. But in this final month, we're digging deeper into our 32-plus years of past programs. Here's an interview with veteran TV anchor Walter Cronkite on his path to prominence as much of the news media followed a lower road. From our July 19, 2009 and December 8, 1996 shows, hosted by Catherine Herzog, Warren Levinson of Associated Press, and me.
Here is a bulletin from CBS News. In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
When Walter Cronkite broke the news of President John Kennedy's assassination, he was already well on his way to becoming the most trusted man in America. From Vietnam to Watergate, from political conventions to outer space.
But back in 1963, the veteran print journalist turned TV anchor was just starting to see the news media transform itself from a world of brash pencil pushers to blow-dried charmers or screamers, of which he despaired. Cronkite, who died last week at age 92, talked about his career, his critique, and his memoir, A Reporter's Life, on Newsweek On Air in December 1996. My co-host, then Warren Levinson of AP, began by asking what got him into journalism.
Well, a magazine article, as a matter of fact, in a magazine called American Boy, back obviously quite a few years ago when I was an American boy. And they were running a series of short stories which were meant as sort of career guidance. And the short story about the newspaper man was the one that grabbed my attention more than all the others. I think that was the first indication that I might become a newspaper person, a press person, a writer, a reporter. It, however, coincided very nicely with my entering high school with the great good fortune of having a journalist. journalism course there, taught by an editor on his spare time. He was an inspiration indeed, a guy named Fred Burney. The two of those things together just propelled me into the business, and I've never had a regret since.
As a high school journalist and a cub reporter for United Press myself, I dreamed about being city editor of the World Telegram and Sun in New York, now long dead. Unfortunately, I never made it. What was your goal at the start, and when did you realize that you were going to go a lot further?
I think that my goal was to be managing editor of a good competitive newspaper somewhere in the country. The bigger the city, the better. So I probably was dreaming of New York, maybe the World Telegram, since my early stages were on the Houston Press. We would have been competing for the job.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
You call your book A Reporter's Life, and yet the way most of us know you is those years as an anchorman at CBS. I mean, tell me about the difference between them.
Well, you know, I think that if I brought any strength to television news and an evening news program, it probably was the newspaper experience. I don't think that as you put together an evening news broadcast, there should be very much difference between that and being managing editor of a newspaper. As a matter of fact, I wanted the title of managing editor when I went to the evening news, and it got copied a lot around the country after that. In a more meaningless form, I think. In my case, I really was the managing editor. We plotted out the day's news, the format, what we're going to do that day, and where we should put our strength in correspondence, what we expected in for our edition, our final edition, which was our only edition. I wrote those pieces that I felt was necessary that I write, or that I wanted to do a little bit differently than our writers, who were very good on our broadcast, did them. So it was very much the same kind of a job as being a managing editor of a paper. We, of course, had to write for the ear instead of the eye, and we were basically a pictorial medium in television, but it wasn't that far different from being a managing editor on a fast-breaking daily paper.
But as a guy in front of the camera, didn't you also have to be a good actor? I mean, I don't know where you look at when you, what you think of when you hear that phrase, the most trusted man in America.
Well, as I keep saying, they didn't pull my wife and that. Sure, it's a little different being on camera than simply being a managing editor, although I've known a lot of managing editors I think had a little ham in them. They acted like they were appearing on the stage and front page. But I guess it takes probably a little ham. But I believe the most successful anchor people and news broadcasters are those who aren't concerned about appearances, aren't attempting to perform, but are really desperately attempting to be understood as they deliver the news.
You say at the end of your book that you don't feel you made a difference, that the successful career is looking back and saying you made a difference, at least in terms of the standards and practices of broadcast journalism. But the whole nation thought you helped it through the JFK assassination. Lyndon Johnson saw your report on the Tet Offensive in Vietnam as proof of vanishing public support. You helped focus serious attention on the Watergate scandal that led to the only resignation of a president. Off-screen in speeches and interviews, you helped start a backfire against Vice President Spiro Agnew's media bashing in the 70s. Isn't that making a difference?
Well, I think that sort of thing probably made a difference. I didn't state myself very well in the book. I think probably it's been picked up by some of my friends that lead into the last chapter. I meant that to apply to the rest of that chapter, which was primarily a discussion of television news. And I was afraid that what I was trying to say was that some standards that I think we set down in the early stages of television news broadcasting have sort of gone by the wayside in recent years. And that's where I meant to say I felt that maybe we didn't make a difference after all.
Do you think there's any chance of those standards coming back, given the kind of competitive pressures that you didn't have to be faced in the era before everybody could get 50 or 60 channels?
That's right. We were very fortunate in my day, those of us who are participating in the three networks, in that the competition was severe between us, but we didn't have all of the divertisements that the people have today with all the cable channels and other other things to go to, the like internet, for instance, today, which probably makes some difference. But with those, with the situation we had, as competitive as we were, we all were sort of concentrating on doing the news. We understood the limitations of the half hour that we had to deal with, and we spent those 21 minutes that were left to us in the news hole after advertising and ins and outs and all were deducted, a very small amount of time to try to cover such a complicated world and a complex nation as our own. There's no time for the feature treatment that the network programs are giving today. Internet Def clearly to compete in a narrowing market, but at the same time, I regret that they aren't paying attention to more news and less feature.
Is it hard to avoid watching the news now with without a hypothetical red pencil stewing over how you would do it better?
And, it's very hard. I sit there, I flip around to the three networks, and I'm constantly dictating a note to them in my mind as to what ought to be done, what shouldn't be done.
Walter Cronkite on the December 8th, 1996 broadcast of Newsweek on Air, almost 40 years to the day since anchoring man's first moon landing, literally the high point of his career. Cronkite died at home in New York after a long illness, with family at his side, but little reason to feel better about the news. The tributes began immediately, and as Cronkite would say, that's the way it is. Cronkite on Cronkite and the Media, from our July 19th, 2009 and December 8th, 1996 shows. The faces of TV news continue on Fast Forward. In April this year, NBC News hired a branding consultant to analyze Meet the Press host David Gregory's appeal, or shortage thereof, and he was replaced last week by the network's chief White House correspondent, Chuck Todd. At ABC, Diane Sawyer ceded the World News Tonight anchor desk to far-ranging, far younger domestic and foreign correspondent David Muir. But over at CBS, Face the Nation host Bob Schieffer says he's not planning to leave anytime soon. Washington today is what Rome was when it was the capital of the known world, he told the Amtrak magazine this month. Why would I want to quit? It's fun. I'm David Alpern. We'll visit the archive again next week. Now, a mordant musical tribute to the news business by Earl Robinson and Vern Partlow.
Oh, a newspaper man meets such interesting people. He knows the lowdown now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, a newspaper man meets such interesting people. He wallows in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, city desk, hold the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test, yes, a newspaper man meets such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press. Ha, 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 ha. You remember Mrs. Sadie Smuggery. She needed money for a new fur coat. To get insurance, she employed skullduggery. She up and cut her husband's only throat. She chopped him into fragments. She stuck them in a trunk. She shipped them to her uncle back yonder in Podunk. Oh, a newspaper man meets such interesting people. It must have startled poor old Sadie's unk. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, city desk, hold the press, inside story, good and gory. It's a mess, meets the test, yes, a newspaper man meets such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press. Yes, a newspaper man meets such interesting people. I've met the gal with million-dollar knees, the guy that sat 5 years upon a steeple, just where the point was I could never see. I've met Capone and Insull and many other fakes. I've even met a genius who swallows rattlesnakes. Oh, a newspaper man meets such interesting people. The richest girl who could not bake a cake. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, it's terrific. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, it's stupendous. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, it's kalousy. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, it's the nuts. Oh, a newspaper man meets such interesting people. It's wonderful to hear the presses roar. Now publishers are such interesting people. Their policy's an acrobatic thing. They shout they represent the common people. It's funny Wall Street never has complained. But publishers have worries, publishers must go. Two little guys for readers and two big shots for their dough. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, get that payoff, keep those readers. What a headache, what a mess. Yes, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give 3 cheers for freedom of the press. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union. They won a living wage. They joined progressive actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen meet real interesting people who know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild. We got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill. All together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen meet real interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the guild.